When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Thank you for all of you who downloaded yesterday's, the biggest day we've ever had on the podcast. I don't know what it was about yesterday's podcast. It proved so interesting to everyone. But anyway, it's lovely for that. If you wanted to tell your friends, or better still, go online and post a review on your Apple podcast. It helps with the mumbo jumbo charts, apparently. Or if you just want to get in touch, let us know about the podcast. You can email me, matt.chorley@times.radio. Right, a complete change of tone on the podcast today. For our big thing today, we've caught up with Claire Fisher. She was on the show last year. She'd messaged me to say she used to listen while she was having chemotherapy. She's a former civil servant, started a campaign called Dying Well to try and improve end-of-life care. Well, Claire is now in a hospice, but I caught up with her on Zoom this week. And a really moving but thoughtful interview with her coming up on the podcast today for a complete change of tack. Before that, though, it's our columnist panel, where we will talk about Boris Johnson, of course. It's normally on a Thursday night at the Marriott, but no James Marriott this week because he's off cramming for his mocks. So instead, this week is with India Knight and Hugo Rifkin. Go on then. Who wants to start? Boris Johnson, can he survive? India.
It's a good question. I'm not entirely sure, actually, of the answer. Interestingly, yesterday I had a parcel delivered and the DPD delivery man wanted to talk about it. Then in the co-op, the cashier wanted to talk about it. And then out on a dog walk, another random man wanted to talk about it. And I think, you know, when it is... clear that people who aren't kind of political nerds are really, really livid about something, then the something is very serious. So I'm not sure he can. I think certainly if anything else were to come out, that would be curtains. I think people's...
The curtains have already come out. We know all about the curtains and who paid for them.
The curtains have come out. I don't know. I think he's in a really precarious position.
Hugo, it's a good test, that, isn't it? I mean, my view, if politics drips into non-political WhatsApp groups that I'm in with people who aren't normally remotely interested in my job, when they start asking what's going to happen then, is he going to go, that's when it's, you know that this story has got proper cut through.
Yeah, look, I mean, I should start by apologising because I know this is a work event we're having at 10:30 in the morning, but I'm afraid I thought it was going to be a party, so I'm absolutely hammered on gin and I hope that's not going to be a problem. Look, the question of whether Boris Johnson is going to go, if Boris Johnson was the sort of man who resigned because he'd been sort of revealed to be humiliatingly terrible at his job, I don't think he'd be there, nor would he have been foreign secretary, nor would he have done any of the many, many jobs he's done in his life. So I think sort of waiting for him, the penny to finally drop with him, I think is a sort of fool's errand. It's all about whether the Conservative Party will put up with him or not. And they don't seem wildly over inclined to sort of wield the knife at the moment either. So I don't know. I sort of think it seems sort of like inconceivable that he could still be there in in a month, and yet it also seems inconceivable that anyone's going to do anything about it.
Yeah, all eyes do seem to be on Rishi Sunak, it has to be said. By disappearing to Ilfracombe yesterday and then late last night issuing the lamest endorsement of the boss I think I've ever seen.
But Matt, so my Rishi Sunak issue is Rishi Sunak, you know, everyone's like, oh, he's the clean slate who can sweep in. Rishi Sunak lives in number 10 Downing Street.
Yes.
And so did he never look out the window? You know, I mean, it's like if there were all these parties going on, if anyone in the world knew about them, it's surely Rishi Sunak. He lives right there, you know.
Unless he's sitting there, you know, with his hoodie on and his big Beats headphones, looking at photos of himself on Instagram. Maybe that's how he missed it.
Well, maybe he's just sitting there furious, you know, writing cross notes to people. It's a good point. He can't have been entirely oblivious.
Maybe he's one of these people who sort of sends out anonymous tweets going, my neighbours are having a party again.
I suppose, what was he supposed to do? Go down the stage as, like a citizen's arrest?
Yes. Just go and shout at them in the traditional manner, you know, lean out of the window and go, oi, you're making too much noise, and anyway, it's not allowed.
It would have been quite, yeah, throw a bucket of water over Boris Johnson. It would have been quite a thing if it emerged in May 2020 that Rishi Sunak had broken up a party that Boris Johnson was having next door, you know, with sort of slightly shaky mobile phone footage of shouting over the garden fence. But his message yesterday was, it said, I've been on a visit all day, continuing to work on our hashtag plan for jobs, a hashtag no normal person's ever used, as well as meeting MPs to discuss the energy situation. The PM was right to apologise, and I support his request for patience while Sue Gray carries out her inquiry. I mean, yes, he should apologise, and let's just wait and see how completely screwed he is when Sue Gray's report comes out. But do you think, India, that he's got the killer instinct, Rishi Sunak?
No, I don't at all.
That's interesting. Yeah. Is he just a bit too nice?
He's too nice. He's too shiny. He's too rich. He's too slick. No, I don't think so.
Oh, Hugo.
I don't know. I mean, his suits always alarm me. He always looks like he's wearing an all-in-one bodysuit with a suit painted onto it for reasons I've never been able to wear. It just does, you know what I mean? Like, it's a T-shirt with a tie kind of sort of drawn on. He has a certain kind of sort of Miliband-esque weediness about him that I think, you know, people might kind of become more and more aware of the more we see of him. I mean, he obviously, you know, he'd obviously go for it. He obviously thinks he can do it. I'm not sure he'd necessarily be the best at the job. No,
it's interesting. George Grills on the Times tweeted this morning, I think, saying that people have pointed out, one Tory MP noted, the second time in a matter of months he's been missing in action because Rishi Sunak didn't turn up for the Owen Paterson vote either. And this MP said, when the you-know-what hits the fan, Rishi runs away. And so for every person who's, like, impressed by his wily skills, someone else is annoyed that, you know, they're the ones who have to turn up and do the dirty work while he, you know, goes to North Devon for reasons which weren't totally explained. What about Liz Truss, then?
Also, for me, I'm completely, as I think I've said before on your show, I'm completely bemused by the popularity of Liz Truss with Conservative Party members. I can't get past the cheese and the apples and the really strange robotic delivery. And I also can't get past her endless promotional photographs of herself popping out of tanks or coming down plain steps. So, no, I don't think so either. I mean, and this is obviously part of the problem. You know, if there were an obvious person, I mean, it's bad to have a prime minister who hasn't been democratically elected anyway. But if there was an obvious person to kind of slot in, I think this conversation would be, you know, it would kind of be a done deal at this point. But there really isn't. There really isn't. I don't know, Jeremy Hunt? I don't know.
Well, it was interesting. There is this idea that Liz Truss is hugely popular with the party members. But then there was that YouGov poll of Tory party members that came out end of last week, on Sunday. 33% said they'd most like to see Rishi Sunak, followed by 25% said Liz Truss. So this idea that she's the darling of the grassroots, I'm just not sure as well. She seems to be quite good at mobilising people to the con home online voting thingy, Hugo. But that's not really the same, is it, as having a broad base of support?
there's a slight sort of, I don't know, I don't think this is a sexist thing to say. There's a slight sort of Bridezilla aspect to Liz Truss, where she sort of, you know, she believes it's hers. She's determined to have it. Nobody is going to ruin her special day. But
that's exactly, you know, right.
But and the thing with Liz Truss, you know, she was a Remainer before she began whittering about cheese and so on. And I just don't know. I think despite the sort of Thatcher stylings and all that, I would expect there'd be a lot of people, particularly in the sort of more extreme wings of the Conservative Party, who would fear she'd be a bit of a kind of Theresa May Mark too.
It's interesting that she's a sort of blind set. And there's is Rishi Sunak the sort of slightly dull best man?
Yes, he is. He's too like a cat, and you want someone, I think, as Prime Minister who's more like a dog. He's like a sort of slightly preening, you know, kind of designer cat, not even a nice moggy. He's just, I don't know, I can't see it.
I'm glad, but the metaphors are go-go. Who needs Jonathan Van Tam? Who needs Jonathan Van Tam? Now, let's move on and talk about some proper things. Bob the Builder. The multi-millionaire founder of shows like Paw Patrol and Bob the Builder, Keith Chapman, has said that they wouldn't have existed without creative arts degrees. And he's been trying to extol the virtue of arts degrees over, you know, the sciences, which, you know, science, technology, engineering and maths, which there tends to be a lot of sort of policy focus on. Well, as someone who doesn't have a degree, I mean, I've, you know, but then, you know, I'm not worth quite as much as Bob the Builder. But what were your degrees in?
Mine was in philosophy. So it's sort of an arts, but it's a sort of sciencey arts, I suppose. I don't know.
You use it every day.
Arts or science? Let's think about that. Philosophy. Nightmare.
And you use it every day, I imagine.
You know what? I do use it every day, actually, because, I mean, there aren't many things that are a better training for writing opinion columns and expressing opinions
true.
And formulating opinions than a structure and sort of, like, you know, logical thought. However bad I was at logical thought, it's still useful to learn.
What about you, India? Do you think that he's right that we undervalue the creative arts?
Yes, I do, massively. Partly because the creative arts are fun. And I think the way that children are shoehorned into making decisions that allegedly are going to inform their future careers really, really early on is awful. I think all the fun and creativity and imagination is kind of taken out, and then they're steered towards STEM subjects very young. I think people should go to university and do what they like and what fires them up and what interests them, and that they can decide what area they want to work in afterwards. I think those 3 years, 4 years in Scotland are really, really precious. And I think they need to be utilised properly to make people enthuse and want to find stuff out and not just sort of sit there laboriously taking notes and thinking, God, how boring, but never mind, I'll slot straight into that job or that job. You know, I think everything happens too soon with education, including tertiary education. And I really believe in arts degrees. I think they, without wanting to sound too poncy about it, I think they kind of nourish you throughout the rest of your adult life. I think they're a marvellous thing to have in your pocket.
Good. Let's move on and talk finally about the most serious issue of the day. People who dress up their dogs. Pet owners may be inadvertently hurting their dogs by buying them snow boots, a vet has warned. What sort of idiot buys... I must admit, I'm not... I think popping a hat on a dog for a photo, fine, but they don't need to be wearing coats.
See, I don't even think that. I think even popping on a hat for a photo is awful. I think dogs should be dogs. I can't bear anything that makes dogs less dog-like at all. Any clothes, any accoutrements, any accessories. And I think, you know, those snow boot things, fine if you're taking your dog up Ben Nevis, but not if it's slightly rainy and you're taking your dog for a walk on the pavement. It's crazy.
And
it's because
the number of times when I'm out and I see, you know, quite big dogs wearing what appear to be full-on, like, knitted jumpers.
Oh, but that's to keep them... Well, they wear these all-over bodysuits now to keep the mud off. I say they wear, like, they've decided to keep them on. Owners put them on their dogs to keep the mud off when it's muddy in the park. Look, I'm very much of the view that there is only one circumstance in which you should ever put clothes on a dog, and that's if it's Halloween and you're putting something with extra legs on it to make it look like like a giant spider. That's the only time. It's the only time it's allowed. I read this article today. It just makes me so cross, dogs in clothes. I'm not quite sure why, but it does. It was Sean McCormack was writing in Dogs Today, and he was saying that you mustn't put your dog in dog boots because they're uncomfortable and they're heavy and they often don't fit. But what he said was one of the most common problems with dog boots is that pet parents can find it difficult to recognize when they don't fit their dog correctly. It's like pet parents, this is the whole problem. You're not their parents, you're their owner. You don't put clothes on them, they're not a kid. No clothes,
and also,
it's a spider costume.
Also, putting clothes on a dog takes away from the inherent nobility of the dog. That's what really gets
yes,
me.
Yes, I think you're right.
Terrible. Unless you've got a whippet or a very thin-skinned, short-haired breed.
In our house, we harbour a fantasy that one day we'll come home and find the dog sitting in bed wearing a bonnet and glasses.
dogs putting on their own clothes is a completely different situation.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That's
completely,
fine.
Well, I think we covered a lot of ground there, and we didn't even get time to talk about Gina Miller's new political party, which she's launched this morning. 13 people have turned up. There were baseball caps and everything. Never mind.
Can I give you my Jonathan Van Tam suggestion?
Yes, please.
I go?
What should Jonathan Van Tam do next?
I think he should launch a line of Bluetooth speakers that they mainly sell in airports, because I always think he's already got one. Never mind. JVT? No, no. It's always JVT. Jonathan Vane Thrombosis. I'll go. My time's up.
Have you got anything you want to try and rescue this item with, India?
No, not really. I mourn him in advance because I love him.
I love his face. You love his face. Maybe get him to dress. Can we get him to dress up as a dog? Let's not dwell on that. India Knight, Hugo Rifkin, lovely to speak to you. You can read India in the Sunday Times every week. Hugo, you can read on a Tuesday and on a Saturday in the Times, and you can catch him on Times Radio from 10 o'clock every Saturday too. Get yourself a Times subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/Times Red Box. Up next, how do we die well? It's my conversation with Claire Fisher. You're listening to the Red Box podcast.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How do you feel? Seems like a stupid question. But given that all the conversation we had before was about dying well and making that process as comfortable and as positive as it can be, and I know from personal experience, I went through with my mother-in-law before Christmas, a hospice is a place to do that. So, but then
it's amazing.
Going there, you know what you're there for. And so having never really spoken to somebody about it, how does it feel, that process of getting to where you wanted to be, but ultimately you don't want to be?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of what I've been talking about through Dying Well and a lot about we talked about before is how important it is to have the conversations beforehand and how important it is that people know that they're dying, and how important it is that you have advanced care conversations and you have the chance when you're well to discuss with your family what you want. And so I feel incredibly fortunate that we've done all of that and that we've made a plan and that the plan that we wanted is coming together. And I know I'm so fortunate to have the opportunity to know that I want to be in a hospice and to be able to be in one. And that's just not a thing. You know, one in four people don't get that. And so I feel well. So genuinely, you know, I know what's coming. Maybe we can talk about the difference between being in a hospice and being in a hospital. But it's, I would say having spent 2 weeks in a hospital beforehand is the perfect primer for being delighted to be in a hospice. So that's brilliant. And my family, you know, we're all on the same page. We know where this is going. We know how it's going to be. And we're just, yeah, I mean, I don't know that you're ever ready, but this is the best that for us from where we are now. And I'm pleased and privileged to be here. And as ever, just so aware that not everybody gets that opportunity, which is why I've been working with Marie Curie and talking to you guys about why isn't this a thing that should be part of a standard provision for people? Why don't we look after people properly when they die all the time?
And just actually draw out that distinction, having been in it most recently, people who don't know the difference between being in hospital and being in a hospice when you know you are nearing the end of your life.
I want to start by saying nobody in a hospital is being mean to you. NHS staff are amazing. COVID is a nightmare. There's not enough staff. There's too many patients. It's a bit of a war zone. I don't want anyone to hear anything that I say as a criticism of the hospital. They are just stretched beyond belief. But a few things. So I was admitted to hospital. I'd been basically projectile vomiting over my own bathroom for 24 hours. I wasn't in a very nice state. I got admitted to hospital. When I got into hospital, I asked if I could wash my hair. 2 weeks I wasn't able to wash my hair. 2 weeks I was having to scrag my own hair back with vomit still in it, not able to get a brush through it, spraying body spray at it so it didn't smell too bad. There was just nobody that had time to properly help me wash my hair. You get to the hospice, they say, what do you want? I said, well, if you've got time, could we wash my hair? Yeah, we'll do it now. Proper hour and a half, proper bath, proper somebody that takes the time to clean your hair and wash it.
Something as straightforward as washing your hair, really difficult to do that in a hospital, absolutely what the hospice are doing. And I suppose the thing that I found with the difference was that the hospital, they're trying to make you better. And once it's clear that isn't what they can do, there's a limit to what they then feel able to do, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I've been at the hospice 48 hours. I've sat in the garden and read a book, you know, because they say, is anything you'd like to do today? I was like, yeah. I'd like, could I go sit in the garden? Yeah. So put you in a wheelchair, take you out into the garden, wrap you up in a blanket, give you a cup of tea, leave you to read a book. It's just, you know, whereas I've been 2 weeks in a hospital and haven't been outside. But here I can go outside every day. I feel more like me. I'm in my own headspace, you know, I can have stuff from home. And crucially, my kids can come visit me anytime. So there's no visitors in hospital at the moment. So I've been in hospital, I haven't seen my, I mean, we did do a sneaky, you know, I got wheeled down to the M&S and hugged them in the M&S in the hospital because you're not allowed visitors on the ward. But, you know, so literally I saw my kids for 5 minutes in M&S. But they can pop in anytime they want here. And when they do, they're given hot chocolate and cake and people are nice to them and it doesn't feel like a hospital. So it's just, it's 100 miles apart from, yeah, it's just brilliant.
How old are your children, Claire?
I have two 16-year-olds and an 11-year-old.
And how would they, I mean, I know you've talked about, you know, the importance of having these conversations. How's that conversation been explaining to your children that you're now in a hospice and what that means?
Again, we haven't really had to have that conversation this week because we've had this conversation over the last 3 years. These conversations shouldn't be one conversation. These should be, I think people who are terminally ill deserve to know they're terminally ill, deserve to have the opportunity to slowly, carefully, gradually talk to people and build up to it. I mean, it's never going to be ideal, but I would say it's as untraumatic as I think we could make it.
And do you know how long you'll be at the hospice for? Have you been given any idea?
Well, prognosis is really, really tricky. So I don't really know. I mean, it could be weeks, it could be longer. At the moment, we're not really sure whether I'm absorbing any nutrition at all. So although I'm just about able to eat and drink, I'm not sure that any of it's really doing anything very much. So yeah, I would say weeks, but maybe some, quite a lot of them. It's my best guess at the moment.
Well, that's good.
I don't really know.
That's good news, and being able to, you know, get there and settle into the hospice is really, really good news. The interesting thing, Claire, is that I know that lots of the people will be listening to this and thinking they wouldn't even be able to have this conversation without getting upset themselves, never mind someone else. Yeah. How do you keep it all together?
I mean, I am a Christian, so faith is a huge part of that for me. So I do have a faith about what comes next for me, but also what comes next for the people I'm going to leave behind. But also, yeah, I'm a pragmatist. When I first got my diagnosis 3 years ago, I had a lot of very, very sleepless nights and very, all the things that you would probably expect somebody to go through. And I kind of feel maybe I did all of that then, and now and then I felt like I had 3 bonus years of actually really kind of life that I didn't quite expect to have, where I feel like I've done all the things that I wanted to do, and I feel that's been such a privilege.
Did you have what people call a bucket list as such of things you wanted to do, or was that just events that you wanted to get through, and yeah, it wasn't a sort of physical list?
It was a very civil servant-y list. It was mostly admin. It felt more like, it was very reminiscent of when I went on maternity leave and I handed over my job to somebody else. It felt a bit like that. I was conscious that I was handing over being mum and parent, and, you know, in a family, everyone has different roles, don't they? So I basically handed over all the things that I do in a family, and also just, one of my big goals was that my little one would start secondary school, and that the kids would be in a position where they knew enough about me that they would have a fair chance of guessing what kind of advice I would give them. So I think the only thing I've really changed consciously in the last 3 years is I've shown a lot more of my workings out loud, if you know what I mean, when I've made decisions or when I've said yes or no or stuff in the family. I've been a lot more explicit with everybody about why I'm deciding that, to kind of, I hope, equip them to almost guess, you know, what would I have said about that, or what would I have wanted them to do, or something.
You talked about how important it is that people know what is happening to them, and you tweeted, yeah, I think last week, saying that you spent 2 weeks on the palliative oncology ward, and you said there were still too many people who don't realise they are dying, or even, you know, know really what's happening. And is that a fault of the NHS, or is it a fault of us? Is it a sort of very English British thing of stiff upper lip and everything will be all right at the end? If we don't talk about it, it's not happening.
I think it's everything. I think it's everything, which is why it's so pervasive. So there is a thing, like you said, didn't you? If you're in a hospital, people think you're going to get better. So palliative chemotherapy is a thing. They use chemotherapy to relieve symptoms. But people think that if you're having chemotherapy, it's a treatment and you're going to get better. So I think even when you tick the box for palliative chemotherapy, people think if they're on a treatment, they're going to live, or they're going to get fixed. They don't understand that it might just be symptom control. And even when you hear people saying that, and hearing it, it was as if it just wasn't sinking in. And I recommend, every time I talk, I recommend Catherine Mannix's brilliant book called With the End in Mind, which just describes what dying is like. And she says things like, you don't die because you're not eating, you stop eating because you're dying. So there's lots of people who were saying things like, I've deteriorated while I've been in hospital because I didn't get the physio, or the food's been so unappetizing, I haven't been able to eat it, and that's why I've lost weight. And people, I think, are trying to rationalize what's happening to them. And it's like the missing answer is, you're dying, and this is what normal dying looks like. You will sleep more, you will eat less, you will lose weight. You will just slowly shut down, and that's okay. And it's not that we're neglecting you necessarily. It's just that's what dying looks like.
Tell me about, you joked that you'd taken a sort of civil servant's approach to this. Explain what you did in your life as a civil servant, and then how the Dying Well project came about.
Yeah, so I had a brilliant career. I joined the civil service fast stream, and I worked in all sorts of really interesting infrastructure projects and delivery projects. And I was always really interested in how the evidence should influence what we do as policymakers. And I have been a proud associate of the What Works Centre for Wellbeing, specifically looking at how evidence in wellbeing is a brilliant way of delivering holistic policy in a really meaningful way. And we've done some really interesting, excellent work over the years. And we talk about life events. So we have lots of really good evidence about how retirement or loneliness or employment or divorce or different life events affect people's well-being, and how government interventions can be targeted to do some really great stuff around that, and how we can make the best use of our resources. So when I got sick, I asked those questions, and I specifically asked, okay, so dying is a life event, right? So what does the evidence say about that? What does the evidence say about how we die well? And I was really surprised, and the centre was really surprised to realise actually there's a big gap. And the Nancy Hay and the team at the What Works Centre for Wellbeing have just stepped up, and they've done so much kind of voluntary work around this, really. And we've spent the last year just bringing together practitioners and policymakers and academics, and noticing that we don't think about dying as part of the life course. And noticing we've done some work with Marie Curie and Hospice UK, and even palliative care is not a statutory service. It's, you know, so local health teams have to provide dentistry and midwifery, but there's no requirement to provide palliative or end-of-life services. And there's no real evidence about what works or how to do it well, or what benefits people in a holistic way, which I think also continues into this problem that we end up just treating because it's all about life expectancy and extending life in years. Whereas actually, I think we need a much better focus on quality of life and how do we care for people. And yeah, I don't want more chemo. I'd like somebody to wash my hair, please. So we spent the last year exploring that, and I've just been amazed at the response from a little Twitter account to keep myself sane. We seem to have come quite a long way, and I'm quite excited to see where they go with it next.
So what would you like to see change? I know you've had interactions with ministers and that sort of thing. And knowing from your time as a civil servant how slowly sometimes these cogs can turn. What would you like to see happen?
Well, there's a huge opportunity with the Health and Social Care Bill that's going through at the moment, and Baroness Findlay is spearheading an amazing campaign with the team at Marie Curie to make palliative care a service that has to be provided. Why do we provide midwifery but not end-of-life services? Completely crackers. So much of what's provided in hospices is provided by charities. They're doing amazing work. But what that means is there's inequality of access. You know, not everybody can access it. It's hugely unfair. I am a white, educated, middle-class, middle-aged cancer patient. I'm pretty much guaranteed brilliant end-of-life care. And I think everybody should be guaranteed brilliant end-of-life care. But also evidence. We get to better policy by better evidence, which is why we need to be able to talk about it more, research it more, understand it more. And then we'll be able to target the resources in a more meaningful way as well.
Someone in your position, and having had, like you said, have the time to sort of get your affairs in order, get your ducks in a row, whatever you want to call it, how do you want to be remembered? I mean, it's the old thing that nobody's ever going to look back and say, I wish I'd spent more time at work. But what turns out is the important stuff for you right now, having finally got to the hospice that you wanted to be at? When you look back on your life, what's the important stuff to you?
I don't know, really. I've never been I've always been a person of fairly modest ambitions. And the thing I always wanted was to have a room to myself that was full of books, like a little library or a study. So I've achieved that and I was very happy with that. I love my family, you know, just I think we did a good job of having some nice children. I think they're going to be great grown-ups. I've always been fairly modest in just trying to find the happiness every day, really. And I have mostly, and that's kind of what I'm still doing.
Oh, you really are. And I've been following your tweets, whether it's flowers or birds and stuff. And you think, well, actually, that's really, you know, that's the stuff that matters, not the pile of emails building up in your inbox.
Although I do also have to say, it has been incredibly important for me to keep working. I'm not sure that people say they wouldn't spend more time at work. Well-being evidence, having purposeful, meaningful work is hugely beneficial for well-being. So literally, you know, I couldn't do a proper job anymore. I basically made up the Dying Well project because I wanted something useful and purposeful to do. And that's been really important. So yeah, balance is important, I think.
Oh, yeah, I could totally see that. Rather than sort of giving up work and just sitting and waiting to be ill, having something to work on.
Yeah, birds are all well and good. But if I was literally just watching birds all day, I think I would have gone completely bonkers by now.
Or even listening to Times Radio, because this is how we first got in touch.
Yeah.
Because you messaged me one day and said you were listening to Times Radio while sitting having your chemo, and you told me to make it a good show, which felt like a lot of pressure.
Well, exactly. You know, I'm a civil servant. So, you know, what I do is in the hospice, I start the day. I'm literally, my next thing to do is organise getting newspapers delivered, because now I've got time to read newspapers. You know, I want to stay interested in the things I'm interested in. So yeah, you'll get me listening along much more regularly now, Matt, because I am much more available. So keep them good.
well, that's a lot of pressure. I will do my best to live up to that, Claire. I don't know what the right thing to say is, but we just sort of wish you well and your family all the love and support that they need over however long it is. And I'm sure lots of people really appreciate you sharing your story.
Thank you so much. It's been a great little meeting, and thank you so much for the extra support that you've given to the work that we're doing, and for helping. That it's great just to have the opportunity to show people that these conversations don't have to be awful. Dying is just as normal part of living as being born and all the things in between, and we need to get better at doing
it. Nobody will ever regret having that conversation. But the not having had it will cause problems later on. Claire Fisher, good luck, and thank you for sparing your time at Times Radio.
It's all right. Thank you so much. Bye.
Well, let's actually turn our attention then to the policy issue that Claire was talking about, and why palliative care is a bit of a postcode lottery as to where you live and your ability to access those services. Sam Royston is Director of Policy and Research at Marie Curie UK and joins me now. Hi, Sam.
Good morning.
The Health and Social Care Bill then is in the House of Lords today, and the case for palliative care is being made, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. Baroness Laura Finlay has got down an amendment which would add in to the bill the requirement for every part of England to be delivering palliative care services. And it's such an important change that could be made, because at the moment there's no such requirement. It's been the case for decades, and the consequences of it are really severe in terms of making sure that people have access to those services which support people effectively at the end of life.
And in the conversation that I had with Claire, we were talking about this, I think, after we'd stopped recording as well. And she mentioned, you know, you have to have, you know, there's a statutory requirement for dentistry and ophthalmology and all these other things, which is right and proper, and people should be able to get a dentist. But it seems extraordinary that given that, you know, the blunt truth is we are all going to die at some point, it's not a requirement that there was proper palliative care in place for everyone.
Absolutely. It's incredible. And what a fantastic, amazing interview with Claire, by the way. That really was incredible. But there are so many things. There's a clause in the bill. There's a part of the bill that sets out that these new boards that will be responsible for delivering healthcare services across the country will have to deliver dentistry. They'll have to deliver maternity services. Quite rightly, they'll have to deliver ophthalmology. But they won't have to deliver specifically support for dying people. And that's just, it's incredible that that's the case, but it's incredible that actually this isn't something new. This hasn't been the case for decades.
And so what would be the impact, were this to be, I know some peers are trying to get it into the bill, were it included, is there a financial implication of it? Is it a resources thing that the government won't do? I mean, that's not an excuse, because we find money for all sorts of things. Is that part of the issue?
Well, at the moment, we think, Marie Curie think, that around 90% of people, 9 out of 10 people who die, would have benefited from specialist palliative care services, from some specific support around their support needs as they're dying. But only about half actually get that support. So there's already a huge gap in terms of the provision of support that's available. And we know that that's likely to grow in future, just simply because we've got an aging population with more people who are dying each year. We think that this amendment is a crucial step towards making sure that health commissioning bodies, the bodies that are responsible for deciding what health services get delivered in every part of the country, take some responsibility for delivering specialist palliative care services that can make sure that people get that targeted wellbeing support that they need towards the end of their life.
Sam, it's really good to speak to you. We'll keep across what's happening in the House of Lords with the Health and Social Care Bill. That's Sam Royston, Director of Policy and Research at Marie Curie UK. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.